Hi, everyone. This is Dave Newbert, Marketing Director for Eagle Eye Power Solutions, and welcome to our podcast, DC Power Hour, the show where we will discuss everything related to, you guessed it, critical DC power solutions. So charge up, power on, or do whatever it takes to get yourself excited for the episode of DC Power Hour. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of DC Power Hour. Very excited for today's episode on ground fault testing. And we've got some great guests. Of course, we've got the Battery Blarney duo, and we've got a special guest in the studio that I will introduce here in just a second. But I did want to give a little bit of a shout out to one of our listeners. So there actually are people out there listening, George and Alan, and you know, besides our guest. And we're really excited to get this note from a listener named Sam from down in Australia. And he says, fantastic podcast and awesome company. If you're looking for anything DC power related or anything in relation to critical loads, this is your company. Massive fan of the guys over here in Australia. I share the pod with everyone in the industry over here that I can. I even use episode 17, how to walk out of a battery room alive, as a form of induction for new guys. Looking forward to attending at BatCon in the future. Keep up the good work. Sam in Australia. So thank you very much, Sam. Really excited about that. And I want to get the guy's feelings on that. And we've got another loyal listener, Ron Dickinson. We'll introduce or have him introduce himself here in a second. But really excited to hear from the listeners. We want more listeners to submit your questions. If anybody else wants to be on a podcast like Ron is today, please let us know. And we just want to keep giving you guys the information that you're looking for. So thanks for that feedback. And yeah, what do you think, Alan and George?
Well, look, those guys in Australia, they must be, you know, having a tinny too much. A tinny in Australia is a can of beer. So they must, or else they're getting us confused for some other podcast. But anyway, thank you guys. It's nice to be appreciated. We don't get very many negative comments, but we appreciate those as well. So anyway, going to talk about ground faults. I know a little bit about grounding, not a lot about ground faults. So I'm going to let George take over for most of this, and I'll just kind of act as a moderator here. So George, you want to take off?
Oh, yeah, let me first thank Sam for his kind words. You know, I have suggested that perhaps we could go to Australia and do a live version of the podcast, but at the present moment, I don't think our finance director is in the mood to allow that.
Okay.
However, you know, I live
not in
hope.
This year's budget, yeah, maybe.
It's not in this year's budget, as you say. But anyway, it would be fun.
It would be.
So anyway. Yeah, ground faults. Yeah, unfortunately, I seem to become a little bit of an expert on ground fault tracing because we actually have a product that we sell that does it, but it has its challenges to make it work. But I'm going to be very interested to talk to our guest here, Ron, because I understand he's started to see some ground faults on his installations, and I'd be interested to hear what his problems are.
Well, before we go on to that, George, you know, when I think of a ground fault, I kind of the old-fashioned school when I was working with batteries that were grounded, right? So it wasn't a problem. But to me, you know, a ground fault was a short circuit. Okay. Now, I do realize that when we talk about ground faults here, we're not talking about short circuits from hot into ground, but something in between. And it can be you can describe it as soft ground, George, or it's just not necessarily a short circuit in my way of thinking. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what a ground fault is, George, and then we can delve into your expertise.
Okay. And what the ground fault is basically as Alan said, if you work on the telecom industry where we spent a lot of our life, we always ground one leg of the battery. And part of that is to minimize corrosion on the buried cables. Like, when I put it this way, that is what I've always been told. The old-fashioned UPSs, when they had transformers, on the front end, the isolating transformers, the battery in the UPS, was then ungrounded. Today, with the transformerless inputs, the battery is now grounded based on the fact that the negative of the supply is grounded at the origin. So we no longer have, or we could still have ground faults on the battery, but much more difficult to trace. The remaining sort of location for ungrounded batteries are the utilities, where they typically use 130 volts and they are, you know, they're ungrounded. That's the way they are. The problem is, though, that if you do develop a ground on either the positive or negative side of the battery, you can actually do a lot of damage. If it's a very, very small ground, very, very high resistance one, it may not impact the operation of the system. On the other hand, if it's a very solid ground, we have seen battery fires. We've seen equipment fail because of it. And what is more troubling than anything else is the fact that once that ground occurs, that means that the operator or anybody working on that battery that might believe that as long as they're insulated, they can touch it, may not have, they may now be susceptible to getting the 135 volts is referenced to ground, and they can be shocked and possibly killed. So it's one of the reasons why it's so important that we understand the potential impact for a ground fault on an ungrounded battery system.
That was a great summary, George. I appreciate that. I just want to get our listeners familiar. We're not talking about short circuits here, short circuits to ground, basically. But maybe it's a good time to bring in our guest here. So if he'd like to introduce himself, that would be great.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. I can hear you perfectly.
Okay, just making sure. My name is Ron Dickinson. I am an E&I tech at a power plant in Oklahoma. I happen to work on the batteries and have been doing that ever since day one. And I have now 14 years experience in the power industry. Still learning every day. George and Alan, I have been getting answers from these guys, which are really, really good information. And just to let you guys know, we have been experiencing some ground faults lately. We had a flooding and we had water get up in some instrumentation. So our 130 volt system did get grounded, but we dried everything out and it's back to normal. Speaking about elaborating real quick, the 130 we have here is ungrounded, as well as our 24 volts on our LM units. We have, when we see ground faults, it's typically a hard fault. You've had a wire get loose, something rub. And one of the big benefits of an ungrounded system and or a floating system is, yes, like you said, the safety aspect. We can work on the batteries safely or work on instrumentation in the field without worry about getting shocked unless the system is in a ground fault. If it's in ground fault, now you have a potential. That just happened to a fella yesterday, a contractor working on new valves. He got tingled by 48 volts. And I said, "Hope, that must mean we have a ground fault." And later that day, they announced that, in fact, all three units had ground fault. So it does save people. It saves getting hurt and your equipment. It just seems all around better having a floating system. I haven't seen a grounded system here. And I don't think we have in our corporation any like that. So I'm learning there.
Ron, the possibility the 48 volt systems are grounded on one leg. They typically ground the positive leg of the battery on a telecom system, because that's one of the challenges you have when you're trying to find a ground fault. There can be an occasions that shall we say especially if the telecom system is using the station battery as the supply for the telecom system. So it has to go through a converter to take it from 130 volts down to 48 volts. However, that converter has to be fully isolated. Otherwise, when they ground the positive within the telecom system, you start to see a ground fault. I have traced a few of those out in my time. But it's interesting, you said that you had some ground faults. How did you recognize that you had ground faults?
Well, our batteries, the battery chargers have ground fault detection on them. Then it goes to the, it sends an alarm to our Ovation or DCS system. So the operators noticed it. And it happened during the weekend before we came on an outage and nobody let us know, just a bad communication issue. But we found out 2 days later and started drying out all our instrumentation where there was flooding and cleared it up. Water got in places it's not supposed to be. But the 48 volts happened to be on an IO point. So it was a digital input from a valve telling position. And so it came off of a converter, is like you said, we don't have a 48 volt system, but the card itself is on a power supply that gives it a 48 volt.
Okay.
Just George, when you were talking about the isolation of the DC to DC converters, I thought that was an excellent point. You just kind of beat me to the punch there. But the whole thing is so confusing with grounded systems. As George indicated, in the telecom world, 48 volts, that's 48 volts in the United States. Elsewhere, it could be 60 volts. But they grounded the positive, which seems like fast backwards, but they grounded the positive because they, George said, they did find out that with retarding corrosion. They also found out, rather interestingly, that it reduced noise on the telecom circuit. I don't know how that worked, but they did find that out as well. But the confusing thing is, I'm going off tangent here as usual, but on the 24-volt system, just for a bit of education for people here, in the 24-volt system used in cellular, the negative is grounded, just to confuse you. So if you don't know what you're going into, always check the polarity of the ground. But the cellular system, negative was grounded because it grew out of the trucking industry, out of the mobile radios on trucks. And of course, on a truck, the 24-volt battery is negatively grounded. So anyway, back to you, George.
You just add to the confusion, don't you, Mr. Byrne, all of us, but never mind.
Well, we try and take a boring subject less boring.
That's true.
I can always talk about some of my experiences with not being careful with grounded systems, but we'll let that go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can, just as a point, even with a positive grounded telecom system, let me tell you, if you get an additional ground in there, especially within the battery, you can get a nasty shock when you're working on it without any problems at all.
Don't say, George.
You can't have a short sleeve shirt on and your elbow catches the ground when you're touching the wrong piece of the battery. Yes. I speak of experience on that one. But anyway, one of the things, though, Ron, is that I want to bring up here, because this is something that I come across all the time when I'm trying to help people trace faults on the ungrounded system. If you have, almost certainly, if you have a ground fault detection system within your charger, now I would say it's 90% of the time, that grounding detection will actually put a ground on the battery. It will put two balanced resistors, very high resistance, but two balanced resistors down to ground. And what the detection does is it detects a change in the voltage across either of the two resistors.
That's correct.
That's what gives us the ground detection. But it's important to understand that, because when you're trying to use you were lucky, you simply dried out all the areas where it had got flooded, and you were able to clear the ground fault through that. But if you have to try and trace the ground fault with one of the pieces of equipment, there's a number of them on the market. We We sell one, in fact, which is the reason why I go out and do training on it. But most of them work exactly the same way. They inject a low AC signal, a low tone, effectively. In our case, it's 10 hertz. That's, you identify which of the two legs of the battery are grounded, because the way, if you measure them from each one to ground with a meter, the one that will have the lowest voltage is the polarity that's grounded. So you basically connect the signal, the AC signal, to that polarity to ground. And then you use a clamp and a sensor to go around trying to trace that signal through the cable assembly. And it does, when it's working, and when you can get at all the cables, it works very well. One of the biggest challenges we have, and I love this opportunity to talk about it, is the fact that because you have that actual high impedance ground or balanced ground within the detector, you have to, the AC signal, your tone that you're injecting, it still sees that as a ground. It doesn't matter about it balanced, it simply goes to ground. So you will try to trace the signal and you'll always get pulled back towards the charger. And that can be a major problem. You simply can't get past that first part of the test because of this. So you have to disconnect the ground. But it turns out it's not that easy. Some of the modern chargers, like our own, we now are putting a switch in them so they can simply be switched off and totally isolate that ground sense that's connected to the ground sensor circuit within the charger. But a lot of people try it just by simply turning the charger off or turning the DC off or pulling a fuse out of a control circuit. But the problem is, in most cases, that doesn't actually disconnect the ground from the control card. And you can turn the whole thing off. Sometimes you actually physically have to remove the charger from the circuit and rely on the battery to keep you going in order to do it. I speak from experience. We had this. I was doing a training last week, and it was a very interesting place. I won't bore you with where it was, but all I'll tell you is that they had a whole pile of old chargers there, some of them 20 plus years old, and we lacked the service manuals that were easily available in order to try and find out how to disconnect that reference ground. We did in the end, through a bit of luck, because there happened to be a green wire and we tried lifting it, and that worked. But it's something about when you're actually trying to trace these grounds, that depending on the type of ground sensing you have to give you a ground fault alarm, you have to get rid of it, or at least get it all disconnected in order to be able to do the tracing outwards from where you are. So I think you were lucky, the fact you could dry it all out.
Well, we've been fortunate enough to have a fuse bank that feeds all our circuits, and we've had to use that old school way of tracing down where the problem is by removing fuses and checking our voltage. And when it clears up, then we know we're on the right track. Then it's a matter of getting the paperwork out, finding everything on that circuit. It's time consuming and we've had good luck with it, but we are interested in getting a ground detection meter so that we could find it faster and better.
It's, as I said, yes, the traditional way has been to simply disconnect. However, people are getting less and less willing to accept, you know, the fact that you might drop their favorite TV program in your attempt to change or find a ground fault. They don't seem to accept that any longer, you know. So it is a difficult challenge, but it's a fascinating challenge. But that's, you hit the nail on the head. That's one of the easiest ways to do it, is simply disconnect each circuit. And as soon as you lose it, at least you know where it is. The bigger challenge you will find as you work on it, but you're actually in a generating plant, aren't you?
Yes.
So do you get involved in the circuits that go out to the fields where, you know, where the substation is that distributes the power?
Not that side. We strictly stay on this side of the switchyard. So the generator and the BOP power. So everything within our plant, that's for the relay guys.
Yeah. Yeah, that I had a feeling that was what it was, because it's the guys that are on the other side that have the problems, because, you know, I had one location where we managed to disconnect the ground fault detector and the charger. We were able to trace it through a number of panels within the substation, which led out to another distribution panel out in the field, and we traced it to there. Identified the circuit breaker. It was coming away from that circuit breaker. Managed to, you know, through having actually got some drawings on site, which were good. We worked out where it was going to. It was going to one of the major circuit breakers. And we got permission from network ops in order to at least take the cover off it, the control part, so we could see, and we couldn't find it. And it was, okay. So we have it at the other side of the circuit breaker feeding this, but we can't detect it on the other side, down at the actual equipment itself. So we assumed that the ground fault was someplace along the cable, which was not a happy thing to think about, trying to trace that, which whereabout in the cable would it be? But luckily, as they were working on it, he put the clamp round a bunch of the drain wires that were terminated at that particular board. And lo and behold, he found the signal. So clearly, somehow the ground wire was cutting into one of the cables. Or, you know, it was a drain wire, so it was bare copper, you know, tin copper wire. We made the guess at the end that because when we looked at it, we realized it had been pulled rather tight. And we maybe assumed that it was maybe cut shorter than it should have been. And if they'd already cut the drain wire off because we couldn't see it, it may have pulled it up, and the sharp edge of it where it was cut had gone into one of the cables or one of the wires. And it turned out, I was told, at one of the back cons afterwards I attended, the guys I was working with that day came up and said, you were right, it was the drain wire that had gone into the particular wire because it had been pulled up. So it's what I normally tell the tale of when I'm doing the training, simply because it demonstrates the challenge you have trying to find some of these things.
Ron and George, what do we find that the most common problems or cause ground faults are? Is it wiring, like George said, or is it frayed wiring, or is it contamination on the battery itself, like dust on the cover, or, you know, water?
Well, here it's a physical rubbing for the most part. Someone could have pinched a wire, putting a cover on. On some of our units, they run slack cables. It's the generators are powered by a jet engine. So in the compartment with the jet engine, because they have to be serviced, they don't want to hard pipe all the wiring to them. So they're all in steel overbraid cables. And we're humans, and construction was humans. They ran them over some edges a little too tight, or it was too sharp and no softeners. And that's typically where we find them. Or human error again, someone steps on a cable and it pulls the cable out, and then you rub through at a connector. So it's usually very easy to find, unless it's something in the generator itself. And then that's typically just a faulty ground fault sensor. We have not had any major ground faults on the AC side, but with all the DC, it's been physical things you could see. You typically go back to where people have been working, and then you find it. Every now and then you get the occasional mouse in a charger. Found that a couple times. Snake. It wildlife has to be screened and kept out. They will cause problems. but we've never had a ghost that we couldn't find. It's always been a challenge, but we find them.
Of course, that was going to be my next question. What happens if you can't find the ground fault? Obviously,
Bill,
you guys are too good for that.
Give up. We keep on going until we find it. Fortunately, we don't run all the time, all the units all the time. And in the spring and fall, we have more downtime because less power consumption. So we have the opportunities to disconnect circuits and by branch and get it down to the end, and we find it. We have yet to have one that we couldn't find. The gremlins aren't that smart.
Well, that's what George had mentioned, your ground fault detectors. George, how much time do you reckon that saves people? I know you've did a lot of seminars and talked to a lot of customers. How much time would you reckon that saves, you know, technician time?
The advantage of it is that you don't need to wait for any downtime in order to go and do it. As Ron said, they have downtime. So if they're down, then they have the ability to isolate the individual circuits. On some of the other plants and some of the substations, they don't have that opportunity. And the time between the next maintenance is a long time away. So they have to use some other method of tracing it. But in the end, what it comes down to is shared experience. What I've found by working with this over the last 9 years almost is that there tends to be one or two people in the organization, the techs or the electricians, that get to like doing it. They find it's interesting and they get a lot of satisfaction from finding the problem. So once they get into it and understand how to isolate those chargers, the customer I was with last week, they're raring now they've learned that they've got to isolate the charger. They've been trying to do it without doing that, or they didn't completely isolate it. They didn't understand that switching the charger off doesn't necessarily do the job. So that was a major success. One of the gentlemen I was working with, he's raring to go, and they've got a few they need to find. But it's, I'll come back to your question about where else. Yeah, a lot of the times it's cables that have been basic abrasions. Somebody, as you said, somebody stepped on it. They may well have piled it all into a cable tray and added more on the top and not taken some out that still may be connected to circuits. And they crack or they rub against something. But yes, sometimes it's the battery itself. Sometimes, if you're a dirty battery, especially if it's, for instance, if it's been topped up too high and it goes into equalize, you can spray a lot of electrolyte out through the flame arrestor. And that once that starts to drip down, it may well get down the side of the jar, dry up, and actually corrode part of the rail. I've seen that happen. The other time you may well see it, especially if you've gone over to using the VLA cells, which some of the utilities are doing, and they have a leaking cell inside the steel case. That's a guaranteed ground fault, but to fix a few of those in my time. So, there's water, though. I think water is probably the most common one I hear about, especially on the substations, where underground, vaults and things like that get flooded when there's unusual weather conditions, as we have been seeing for the last few years. Sometimes they simply dry up and they disappear. Other ones don't.
There was a question I was asked several months ago, and I had to think about it, and I'm still thinking about it. Is that somebody asked me, okay, we're putting in this sophisticated battery monitor. Hopefully it was a Vigilant, but if you're putting in a sophisticated, is there anything that can do to detect a ground fault? You think, George.
No, I want to make you... it's interesting you asked the question, because in fact, The Vigilant has got ground fault detection in it, but it doesn't use this balanced ground system. It actually looks, it measures the balance between current within the way that it's been fed from the battery. So it doesn't affect it. The problem you have is that if you have multiple of these resistive ground faults, you can get a lot of false alarms because they start to pass more current, you know, to ground. You only ever want one of those resistive ground fault sensors in the circuit.
So your answer is it may help you.
Oh, it will help you, but if you're using the right, it depends. A lot of the battery monitors don't have ground fault detection. The very early ones did, but they used the balanced resistor method, and they took it out of the system. They stopped doing it because they were having to disconnect it because the charger had ground fault detection on it. How many chargers do you have, Ron, on each circuit? Just one or two?
What was that again?
On your power circuits, do you have one charger or two chargers in parallel?
It depends. On our older units, we only have a single charger. On our newer units, we're going dual charger all around just for redundancy, a lot more reliable.
That's something to be aware of then, that depending on the circuit, the detection circuit in the charger, if you start getting alarms that you have difficulty tracing, it might be the fact that there's interaction between the two sets of detection circuits in the charger.
True. We've been fortunate on those that we've been able to isolate it with the fuses in the field, and there was nothing. We haven't had any erroneous errors or faults with just the chargers themselves. Okay. And they're in climate control rooms, the humidity is controlled. So that I think is saving grace on a lot of gremlins, so to speak. Now, let me go back. You were talking about grounding a leg on the batteries for corrosion. Is that corrosion in the field devices or corrosion of the batteries?
It's corrosion of the actual cables that were going through the ground. It's the old telephone system. It's not applicable on anything within the utility, but on the old telephone systems, you know, the basic old Bell system from many years ago, when it was all copper wire that was buried in cables under the ground, that they found, as Alan said, it both minimized noise, audio noise on the circuits, and it removed a lot of the corrosion, avoided the corrosion of the cables themselves.
So, it was galvanic corrosion, George, I believe. Yeah. You know, two dissimilar metals. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's interesting, some of these, you go back 40, 50, 60 years, some of these guys that work for the Bell companies, Bell Labs, Western Electric, they were ahead of their time, I think. Wonderful, some of the work they did, and some of it still applies to this day. Yeah. But unfortunately, we're in a commercial world now, and Ron, you certainly know what that's like, trying to get money to do anything. But we're in a commercial world, and the battery is not a revenue generator, so it tends to get overlooked. I don't know if that's the case. I know it's the case in your industry, but I don't know if you have to put up with that as well. Or maybe you can't say.
Well, as a technician, I don't deal with the dollar amount. So that's for my boss and the higher-ups to be.
We call it financial engineering. and it's causing a lot of headaches throughout the industry. And, you know, we're talking about ground faults today. So, you know, I wonder if there's an attitude, oh, it's not really doing any harm. Just leave it, you know. We'll spend money on it, finding it later.
Have you experienced that? Alan, there are some, I have been to locations where they've had ground faults that they haven't been able to detect for a number of years. Theoretically, under PRC 005, the maintenance standard, there's supposed to be, there's got to be proof that you're trying to clear them up. But, you know, as long as you are doing something, even if it's saying that, you know, you'll be able to do it the next time there is a shutdown, that will get you by the auditor.
And then if that fails, they write out a PO to Eagle Eye to get George to come in and do some instructing on it. And when he's there to do the teaching, you say, oh, by the way, George, can you look at this grind fault for us? So that's another way they're getting around it, George, I think.
You've noticed?
You know? Oh, yeah. So
I did a 3-day course last year on a shutdown or a partially shutdown coal plant. I did not know you could get as dirty as you did clambering around a coal plant trying to find ground faults.
That's where they're going to be located, is where it's dirtiest.
Oh, absolutely, Ron. Believe me, they were the ones we did find.
That's, you know, a lot of those, talking about the chargers, going off on a little bit of a tangent again, but, you know, they, George, which you're very familiar with, you know, there's people realize they got to put in a redundant charger. And they say, well, you know, we're going to stick with the old SCR charger, you know, it's convection cooled. We don't want any forced air cooled charging in our facility because of the dust, the contamination. And I don't think a lot of companies realize that, you know, there's convection cooled SCR chargers out there. And hell of a lot easier to put in redundancy than it is to put another 100-pound SCR charger on the wall.
Yeah, the modular chargers do that. And that, then you come back to that there is only one actual ground fault detection system. So you're not paralleling up again, because the detection system is in the basic framework of the charger, not in the individual rectifier modules. So that's another advantage. I think it's but some of the problems is the fact that is the lack of understanding about how serious a ground fault can be. If it doesn't appear to be if it hasn't stopped operation, it quite often is, well, you know, we'll get to it. But that's not the case. You know, it could be. I have actually seen, you said you haven't seen a short circuit. I've actually seen one of the polarities shorted down such that, you know, it was sure that one of the polarities was shorted to ground. But what happened then was you had the full 130 volts between the other polarity and ground. And that's how you can really electrocute somebody very fast.
Well, when I said a short circuit, George, I just wanted to, you know, define it from a ground fault, which typically when one thinks of a ground fault, there is some resistance in it.
Yeah. So, any other questions for us, Ron? That's why we have you on here.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to make a note that NERC requires us to check for the ground faults, because not just safety side, it's you trip relays can open up on you and trip a unit. So NERC's all about the reliability of uptime with your units. So I just happened to be taking some skills test and it mentioned that, and I was thinking, okay, that does make a lot of sense. If you are ground faulted bad enough, you can actually shut down units, and then they really have problems, especially during the winter time when we weren't allowed to do anything. All units had to run maximum output and don't even sneeze. It's so a ground fault at a time like that, we would need equipment to be able to locate it. So online, it would be beneficial for us to get a ground fault detector, not trying to be a salesman for you guys, but we are very interested in one, and I need to talk to you about getting a demo.
Yeah, I got two questions for you, Ron.
Sure.
Do you have winter in Arizona?
Well, I'm in Oklahoma, and we do
Oklahoma, sorry. I thought you were Arizona. Oklahoma, I know you do.
It does get hot, not Arizona hot, but it does get cold, and it gets bitter cold. We'll see negative numbers. It's just the way the climate's doing now.
What would you advise your other technicians and engineers in your position, other, you know, companies, other locations. What's your advice to them regarding ground faults?
Stay on them. Don't let them just sit there and ride, because if you have one minor ground fault and then you get another one, it can be detrimental. Stay on them, get them cleared up as soon as possible for reliability as well as safety. I've been fortunate and I haven't gotten tingled by 130 DC out here. I pretend like it's a snake. It's always ready to bite you. This is the first plant I've worked with DC other than UPS's. I think it hurts worse than AC. Honestly, it and your secondary injury is when you get away from it. Now you're going to hit your elbow, your head into something. Stay on the ground faults. Don't let them continue, because if it's severe enough on a circuit, you can have, let's say, a solenoid not fire properly, especially a bigger one. And now you're down and you have to explain why you let a ground fault just sit there and linger. It's reliability as well as safety.
My pet peeve, not necessarily related, but going in and trying to find ground faults, going into a utility, or it could be telecom, that lack of documentation. You know, where's the as installed drawings? Where's the, you know, the, as George mentioned, where's the manual for the charger? What's the, even things like, where's the, you know, the various documentation for the battery? Now, yeah, number of times you can't find that. So my advice to anybody is, if you don't have the documentation, get it. If you can't find it, get it. You know, or buy it, buy some stuff. There's a couple of places out there where you can actually buy old manuals, you know, for some of the chargers, some of the batteries. But lack of documentation, that's my pet peeve. What about you, George?
Well, you're absolutely right. As I said, that was my problem where I was last week. They didn't have the documentation. They, you know, they admitted the drawings probably hadn't been updated correctly at times. And it just, but Alan, you know full well, updating documentation is something that none of us have been any good at when we were doing installation work, is it? You know, it's you change it around, you make it work, and then you haven't got time to do all the rest of the background work. And that's, well, unfortunately, that still stands all the way through. If anything, it's even worse today, because, you know, the idea of paper drawings in some cases is abhorrent to people. They want it online, and you've got to look at it online, because that way it will be kept up to date. The only problem is that you may be in the middle of a plant where you have not got any access to the internet. You may not have access to the internet simply because the service is so poor in there. You know, you can't even use your phone as a hotspot. And in other cases, you simply, you know, we have a couple of utilities where the technicians' laptops are locked out from their going online. So they can't, you know, from a security point of view, from the SIP requirements. So we may, you know, we may have to rethink how we do some of this stuff. But you're absolutely right. If you are trying to find a ground fault, you need to know where all the circuits are going. You need to at least be given a hint when you're trying to find it. Would you agree, Ron?
Totally, 100%. As we have kept all the manuals in since computers have come out, everybody's been a lot better about printing off manuals, keeping one on your phone. I've been doing that. It takes space, but you just have to. Prints is another thing. It's a little bit harder to keep those on your phone, but we have access to them. And our engineers are younger, and they're very good about updating all the drawings necessary. So very fortunate there. As far as the changes that have happened in the past, you will find handwritten notes or nothing. So the older generations that just kept it in their head and didn't write it down, that still bites us. But we have been documenting them and updating all the drawings as we go. Been very fortunate to have the right company and the right amount of time to do that. So that's been a saving grace. We can use those for mapping out our circuits and finding them.
Well,
not everybody has that luxury.
You're the exception, Ron. These days, I think you're the exception. And it just scares me, some of the things that are going to happen in the future, especially as the trained technicians are retiring these days and getting laid off and things like that. It's going to be chaos out there, especially with electrification coming up, overloaded grid. I won't go on. That's a discussion for another day. Last word, George.
Last word? To be honest, I'm not going to have the last word because I've done enough talking on this one. Other than, as I will repeat what Ron just said, if you have ground faults, please go and try and find them. Because if you don't, and then you get other ground faults within the same circuit, you know, of the same charger, for instance, it becomes a lot harder to find them, you know, because you don't know, you're going off in two different directions. And the only other one I would warn people about is that one of the challenges you may have is with the fact that we have moved away from relay based control switching systems over to electronics. A substation today is just 19-inch racks filled with electronics. Be aware that sometimes, especially if you're using the tone-based detection circuits, you may go chasing after a power supply, depending on just the way its input filter is. Theoretically, it shouldn't be responding to anything as low as 10 hertz, but some of them do, you know, and you'll find yourself at a power supply with maybe even a faulty filter in it that nobody would notice. So just, there are challenges to doing all of that stuff. Have you any last questions or thoughts, Ron?
I believe that does it for me. I don't have any more questions, and I've learned a lot today.
And you know where to come when you need help.
Oh, I've asked several questions, and y'all have answered all of them, and I appreciate you guys.
So, David, why don't you wrap it up?
Sounds good. Yeah, thanks, Ron, for joining us. And like George has mentioned, we like to provide the knowledge back to you guys in the field or anybody who has them. So please feel free to reach out, send an email to info@eepowersolutions.com. Submit a form on the website, however you want to do it, and we'd love to hear from you. So thanks, everyone. Thanks, Ron, for joining us. And as always, thanks, George and Alan, for another great episode. We hope you can join us next time. And in the meantime, if you have any questions for the Battery Blarney Duo or anything else you want us to discuss in next week's episode, please email us at info@eepowersolutions.com. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you then.